Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Deborah Eisenberg's much-anticipated new collection of short stories, Your Duck is My Duck, compels us to confront the most disturbing truths about ourselves, from our intimate lives as lovers, parents, and children, to our equally troubling roles as citizens on a violent, terrifying planet. Each of the 6 stories has the heft and complexity of a novel. In her world, the forces of money, sex, and power cannot be escaped. She's a MacArthur Foundation Fellow and a recipient of numerous honors, including the 2011 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction and the Whiting Writers Award. She's published a bunch of short story collections, including Transactions in a Foreign Currency, Under the 82nd Airborne, All Around Atlantis, and Twilight of the Superheroes. Her 5th, Your Duck is My Duck, is published by Echo, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought Deborah Eisenberg to our show. Hello.
Hello. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I left out the fact that there have been two books that have collected previous short stories.
True.
This is your first collection in a dozen years. How long does it take you to write a story?
Demonstrably a very long time. It very rarely takes me less than about a year. But I'm not writing steadily. I teach one semester and I don't write during that semester.
Mm-hmm. And then you say you write about 2 hours a day.
Well, it depends entirely on what stage I'm at and what I'm working on. When I begin something in the early stages, 2 hours is about all I can do, and then I have to sleep. But if I'm finishing something, I can really work around the clock.
And you know when you're finished?
Oh, yes. I don't find it a mystery at all.
Are you ever surprised by what you've written when you read the completed story and wonder, like some of your characters, how you got here?
I'm always astonished. I really have never had the experience of knowing where I'm going. I don't use outlines. I don't have what is generally called an idea.
In other words, when you start, you're not saying, oh, I want to write a story about such and such?
Not at all. Usually there's some sort of urgent feeling, but it's masked. So I don't exactly know what it is, and I just have to follow along.
Some writing teachers tell their students that they need to know everything about their characters, their relationships to money, how they feel on a crowded subway, even if those details don't make it into the story. But you say that you, even though your characters are really well-defined, that you don't really know them.
No, I really don't. Or I don't know them any better than I know other people. Which is to say, there are certainly things about them I don't know and don't care about. I don't care what they have for breakfast. I don't care what their sleep habits are. I don't.
Although in one story we do know.
Yes.
About sleep habits.
Well, that's absolutely integral to the story. But yes, there are a lot of things I don't know, often including their futures.
Mm-hmm. So at the end of the story, you're not one of those people who says, okay, now what happens to
not
this person?
Not at all.
You said that you never would have become a writer if you hadn't gotten encouragement from your longtime partner, Wallace Shawn. Does he still make suggestions about your work? And do you ever make suggestions about his writing?
Every once in a blue moon, I've made an unwelcome suggestion. But I don't really. We we don't show each other what we're working on until we're finished. He really is finished when he's finished. I am not necessarily finished when I'm finished. And he is a spectacularly good reader. And if there's something that he doesn't understand or finds awkward, I definitely pay attention.
You appreciate that, obviously.
Very, very much.
Because we all need editors on some level. I don't know whether your editors at your publishers also make suggestions.
Do you know, I haven't had that experience much, but with this book, my editor and publisher, Dan Halperin, was extremely helpful with the story that was the one I finished last. And I was very baffled by that story. It was completely unlike anything I had ever done. And I couldn't find my way in it for a long time. And he saw the last several drafts, and he was extremely helpful.
Almost every short story writer I've spoken to has told me that an agent and editors at their publishers have encouraged them to write a novel, but you never have. On the other hand, you have written a play and a book about the painter Jennifer Bartlett. So how have you been able to resist?
There hasn't been any difficulty. I'm not interested really in filling up the pages. I know any writing of mine would be much more saleable if it were longer, but I really like to boil things down to the extent that I'm able to.
Although your stories aren't short in the usual sense of short stories, they run around 40 pages or so, and they have the feel of a novel or a novella because you allow yourself to digress.
Yes.
In a way that classic short stories are not supposed to.
That's true. So just think how long they'd be if they were novels. But
And how long they'd take you to write.
And how long they take. Actually, probably not that much longer. I just leave in all the stuff I cut.
In his rave review in the Sunday New York Times, Paul Segal wrote that often your sentences are wild, full of breakneck swerves, leaps in time, space, and point of view, all kinds of syntactic fireworks.
I'm glad.
You're glad that he saw that. Although I am struck by how each story has a different voice.
I'm glad
most writers develop a voice, and once in a while they diverge, but they're pretty much a John Updike story sounds like a John Updike story.
I'm very, very glad you say that. That, of course, is an interest of mine, is to be rather transparent and allow the characters to tell the story. And also, I like to explore different, you might say, tonal values. I enjoy that a lot.
I mentioned that teachers often tell their students certain things about how to write a story. What do you tell your students at Columbia?
Don't listen to what people tell you. Really, every writer, I think, is different. And the objective, in my view, is to access areas and elements of your mind that cannot be discovered in any other way. So that's the task, and go about it in whatever way you need to go about it, and then something interesting and idiosyncratic will show up on the piece of paper.
And obviously it's been appreciated because, except for, I gather, you had trouble getting your first story published, you've been published widely ever since, and I'm assuming that if I were a magazine editor and you said, I have a story for you, I'd be very excited.
I am not so sure. I've frequently been invited to submit a story to one place or another, and the usual response is what is known as an encouraging rejection, but usually it comes in the form of, oh, thank you, send us any other story, just not this one.
A story that you've been working on, you say, for around a year. So yeah. That's why there haven't been, although there have been five collections, I've said, and then two other kinds of collections of collections. It takes you at least 6 years to put together a collection like this?
Apparently so. I mean, the next one, if there is a next one, it might be different. I might sit down after the show and write it. But no, I am a very, very slow writer. I read very slowly. I think slowly. I do everything slowly. I walk slowly.
I'm speaking with Deborah Eisenberg, whose latest collection of short stories is Your Duck is My Duck. And doesn't that title come from a Zen riddle about a Zen master and a duck that are trapped in a bottle?
Well, either it does or it doesn't. That is, somebody told me that somebody had told him this purported Zen riddle, which ends, it's not my duck, it's not my bottle, it's not my problem. And I had that filed away for about a decade. And I did look it up online, and it seemed to be there as a Zen riddle, although it's so improbable, it just seems impossible that it would be. But then I looked it up again, and it had disappeared.
And in your story, it's told by the host at a dinner party who's been a bit inebriated. Did you know when you put that in that that had to be the title of the story?
Oh, yes. The title. In that case, sometimes titles take a long time for me to find. But in that case, I knew that was the title.
Why did you choose to not give the narrator of that story a name?
Very good question. And I have no idea what the answer is.
But was she real in your mind while you were writing, or whether you had a name for her or not?
Oh, as real as any other character is to me, yes.
She meets Ray and Krista at a party, and they immediately invite her to visit them at their home in a tropical estate. They have bought one of her best paintings from her ex-husband, and they're collecting artists as well?
Yes, they're collectors as well as business people. They're plutocrats, tycoons.
And they've also invited a satirical puppeteer composer named Amos Voinovich, who's working on a show called The Hand That Feeds You. Why would they want to collect him?
Oh, I imagine that he had a rather fashionable cult following.
You could have called the story The Hand That Feeds You as well.
Oh, yes.
So what is his play about?
His puppet
show. It's a musical play, right?
Yes, it is. And the narrator has previously seen one of his musical puppet shows, which seems to have been about Scott and Amundsen reaching the South Pole. But this one is about a wicked king and queen who enslave people working in the mines to bring them gold and jewels. And the slaves are serfs and donkeys. Mm-hmm. And there is an uprising, a slave uprising of these serfs and donkeys. And bats function as couriers. But then the slave uprising is quelled and all of the slaves are murdered except for the strongest. And so are the king and queen. And the operation is taken over by some big corporations.
So there's a metaphor here because, in a sense, we're all puppets of the of ruthless corporate executives.
I would say that is the metaphor, yes.
But you deny that you are explicitly political in your writing, but there's always politics there.
It's impossible to avoid them or evade them. I write, as I'm sure almost all writers do, about what composes my mind. One doesn't have any other resource. That's it, if one is writing fiction and not genre fiction. And I find it hard to believe that there are many people in our country or on the planet at this moment whose heads are not stuffed with political problems.
But you also say you resist being explicit about the politics. At the same time, you've set this story during a real estate collapse, the reader gets the sense that we should fear ruthless corporate executives.
That's a statement so true and universal that it can hardly be considered explicitly political.
So was the 2008 recession one of the inspirations for that story?
You know, I really don't remember what started it. It's almost a condition, I suppose, but it seems to be shared by a lot of fiction writers, or my evidence of this is utterly anecdotal. But as soon as one finishes a story, one has no memory of writing it or how it got to be that way.
Really?
Truly.
In this case, Ray is, we mentioned he and Krista are the ones who invited your narrator to their estate. How does he earn his money?
How does Ray earn his money? Well, he buys a lot of land, and he buys a lot of things. He seems to be very, very involved in a lot of business ventures.
He buys eucalyptus trees.
Yes,
we have. I just recently did a show about how flammable eucalyptus trees are.
No, really. Yes. Oh, that's absolutely amazing.
We were talking
amazing.
About all of the fires in California and in Portugal. In Portugal, they have Salazar encouraged people to replace trees. They wanted to do a lot of lumbering with eucalyptus trees, and they just wind up with fires all the time.
That's absolutely amazing. I had no idea. But I did choose eucalyptus very, very purposefully because it figures, at least in this story, in a cycle of environmental degradation. And because there have been repeated floods and then droughts, a lot of the agriculture has washed away or died in this particular area where people earn their livelihoods by small farms, through their small farms. And eucalyptus roots very, very, very quickly. And so Ray, the businessman, has planted all this eucalyptus so that the earth will hold, but then, of course, it does burst into flames and lightning storms.
And although the story addresses some of the most pressing issues of our time, like extreme economic disparity and environmental degradation, it also includes some very funny details. do you just write funny? Do you think it's important to include humor when you're writing about pressing issues?
Well, I don't really put it in with a syringe. I mean, either it's there or
it just pops
it
into your head.
Absolutely. I don't really make a big distinction between funny and serious or funny and sad. It does depend on the distance from which you're looking at something at a given moment. But the things that are very, very, very serious are also from a certain distance quite funny.
The narrator's at a dinner with accountants who are helping Ray acquire a company, and they tell a joke that mentions credit swap rates, which she recognizes as English language, but so highly specialized as to be difficult for anyone not to know, not in the know, to understand. There are a lot of highly specialized forms of English in the modern economy. Does language provide cover for inappropriate business dealings?
Clearly. I mean, clearly that so much of what we understand of business that's going on around us is, it's legal, but it's completely unethical. And yet it's, how do you put this, language washed? Mm-hmm. It's, there's a very sort of clinical language that's used to sanitize it.
And it's only after everything hits the fan that, for example, in 2009, when we started hearing about all of these things that had looked perfectly benign until then, and then realized that they were creating this terrible mess.
Oh, yes. I mean, our biggest institutions, and theoretically the ones that we trust and our lives depend on, for example, banks, it's just unbelievable what banks have been allowed to do.
In one of your best-known stories, Twilight of the Superheroes, which was in an earlier collection and set on September 11th, you wrote, "The wars in the East were hidden behind a thicket of language, patriotism, democracy, loyalty, freedom. The words bounced around, changing purpose as if they were made out of some funny plastic." So you've been thinking about how language can be used and misused for quite a while now. There's a lot about language in these stories.
It's true that there is a lot about language very, very explicitly in these stories. And naturally, I grew up in the middle of the century, the 20th, that is, the previous one. And first of all, I think 1984 was one of it. I read it, I remember, when I was 13, and it was not mystifying in any way, because we were very conscious. I would say a lot of my generation was very conscious of the linguistic manipulation of advertising. So, yes, it's a fundamental concern.
We're seeing that now in all of these political ads.
Absolutely.
Some of them are kind of shockingly misleading, but I wonder, why aren't we more suspicious? Why do we buy into them?
You know, that is such a fascinating issue, I think, and really...
Because we want to believe?
We want to believe, I don't know, I think, you know, we're so bought off, really, by our relative comforts, and also, now that those comforts are diminishing, we're still bought off by the fantasy that somehow we will be comfortable, very comfortable.
You wrote in that story, Twilight of the Superheroes, about that language. What did they actually refer to? It seemed they all might refer to money.
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. Certainly when people speak of freedom and democracy now, usually they're talking about money.
Mm-hmm.
very painful. Oh, can I take back something that I said?
Of course you can.
Thank you so much. I believe that I said that things that are very, very serious are also very funny, depending on your distance away from them. Well, some very, very serious things, you would have to be in another galaxy before right. They were funny.
Slavery's not funny.
There is nothing funny about it from any distance that I can imagine.
So do you know what leads you to see an amusing thing in something? Obviously, you're not going to cross the line when you're writing about something like slavery, but does a light bulb suddenly go off in your head?
I don't
know. Or you just find yourself writing a sentence and say, oh, gee, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, sometimes things, I mean, for example, in the instance I think that you were referring to, the businessman Ray mm-hmm. and his accountants telling these awful jokes, it's the behavior that's funny.
Well, Ray also cheats on his wife, but she takes him back over and over again.
Well, it could be a two-way street. I'm not sure.
You didn't ask them
specifically? I didn't ask them specifically. But I think at the beginning of the story, it suggested that each goes on his or her own way from time to time.
I'm speaking with Deborah Eisenberg, whose latest collection of short stories is Your Duck is My Duck. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. The story Merge, one of the other stories in this collection, is also about language, and it's about privilege. What was the inspiration for that?
Got me. Mm. Sorry.
You quote in it, you quote both Noam Chomsky and Donald Trump, who once said, I know words, I have the best words.
Yes, yes. And it's just such an outlandish statement that it was irresistible to use in the epigraph there.
Are you surprised by some of the statements he makes? Every so often he says things that totally befuddle me, and I wonder who understands what he really is trying to say, and whether they truly respond positively to those things. I'm not sure I understand what "I know words, I have the best words" means.
Who can imagine? No, I think he's winding a skein, a sort of verbal skein of confusion. My sweetheart pointed out that he is something like a stand-up, that he uses some of the techniques. As to what he means or what people are responding to, I don't think it's the words. I think that it is clues to attitudes.
Does Wally feel like he has some kind of insight into Trump, because he's also an actor as well as well, and a playwright?
I'm not sure whether he does, but I was surprised by his observation that this was very much like stand-up, and I thought, oh yes, that's right.
In the story Merge, Keith is kicked out of the house by his father, the CEO of Synth Aqua Solutions, a company that buys up water rights all over the world.
Yes, Synthaquat.
Synthaquat, ah. Keith leaves his cell phone behind and is unable to function without it. And you write, without his electronics, he was a virtual amputee, and that the fine mesh of chats, emails, postings, and so on that had buoyed him along shriveled away overnight. He strained to receive the world's breeding influx, which had sustained him as the plankton sustains a whale, but it was nowhere. Would Keith have met Celeste, his love interest, if he had had his cell phone?
Oh, of course not. Yes, that hadn't really struck me before, but it's an actual human-on-human meeting, which would have been totally out of his sphere.
There was a report in the New York Times recently that some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs will not allow their kids to have cell phones or screens anymore because they know how bad they are for people and brain development.
Yes, that's not at all surprising. I'm not at all surprised that they are the first to sound the alarm, even though I'm sure that they hadn't intended to sound it. But yes, I think.
Are you a sounding alarm? The alarm with this story?
Not really. Although I did have a certain amount of fun with electronics, I am very. I mean, in the story, and I am very ill at ease with much of the electronic world. I'm grateful to have a computer. I'm very grateful for things I can do with it, but it does scare me. And I don't use a lot of other electronics.
People often use their cell phones as a way of not having to deal with other things. In the old days, people in elevators would look at their shoes. Now they look at their cell phones.
Right.
And I'm always amazed when I'm on the subway by how many people I see listening to something on their cell phones. I guess it's a way that it protects us against having to deal with the crush of the crowds.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the stories in this book take place in present day, many of them in New York. The subways are a mess. And you write that the news, quote, like a magical substance in a fairy tale, was producing perpetually increasing awfulness from rock bottom bad.
Yeah, I wrote that a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
And it's gotten worse.
Oh, perpetually increasing awfulness.
Well, the MTA wasn't as hated then as it is today.
Yeah, I continue to love it, but it really is having a lot of problems.
Well, I mentioned language is a recurring theme throughout these stories. Are you thinking about it differently now than you used to?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's just that we're so bombarded with manipulative and misused language. And I was thinking the other day, I actually made a call to order something from an online source. And the person I was talking to on the other side of it was very nice and so scripted that if something unexpected had occurred, I don't know what she would have done, which was, I guess, the usual experience. And I find it increasingly demoralizing because you have no idea what the experience of the other person is.
But it can be very frustrating. You call some company, and for 10 minutes, you just wind up being directed by a non-person to finally speak to a person. And then when you finally get through after waiting for a while and hearing the same messages again and again and again, they are scripted. It's like speaking to a robot.
Entirely. And it's...
What happened to spontaneity?
What indeed? And I think it's mostly demoralizing because it's intended to manipulate. It's so manipulative, which makes one feel shame, I feel.
How do you decide when you're writing a story? Is this something you decide right away, whether to tell it in the first or third person?
No, usually that comes pretty naturally and pretty automatically. But sometimes I have to play around switching back and forth to see what leverages out what.
And many writers have told me that until they got that first sentence, they really could not proceed. Is the first sentence the first sentence you write, or is it something that comes in retrospect as you are in the middle of it and realize you have to go back and start at a certain place?
I almost invariably write sequentially. Mm.
In one of the stories, Taj Mahal, you mix excerpts from a memoir with the critical responses of the people who are written about in it. a group of older actors who get together to talk about the book. Does that story address what many people accuse writers of doing, using their stories for their own purposes?
What would my purpose be with this one?
Well, I'm just wondering. Oh. Writers in general, people often, a number have told me that when their parents or friends realize that a certain thing in a story really was based on something that had happened in their lives, they got upset.
Well, I don't write about real people. Mm-hmm. So, of course, people often imagine that they've been written about, but I don't use real people. And the opposite, I'm told, happens a lot, that from fiction writers I know who do write about real people, the real people never recognize themselves.
One writer recently told me that her mother got very upset when the mother in the story advised her daughter to go into therapy or complained when the daughter went into therapy that it was kind of like a Jacques situation.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
Is Taj Mahal a story for other writers? Obviously, writers draw upon, as I said there, the stories and experiences of friends and family members. How do you decide what you can use?
For me, it's pretty simple. I just don't use...
So you don't have to ask for permission?
I don't. There's one story in that collection that is as close to autobiographical as anything I've ever written. That is, it does have material in it that resembles parts of my family in a highly fictionalized and distorted form. And I did clear it with certain family members who I felt might have felt self-conscious. And although they're not in the story, and nobody living is in that story, other than me, if you count me.
I'm guessing what story that is, and in that story, language can be used in a very cruel way.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
One of the characters in Taj Mahal, Emma, feels as if, and I'm quoting, someone's grimy hands have plunged deep into her foundation's rearranging elements. Are writers aware of the effect their books can have on people? In this case, we're talking about a memoirist. You haven't written memoir, but I'm sure you've spoken to a number of people about it, and often there's a lot of talk about how memoir and fiction often there's a very blurred line.
Yes, and that is why I don't write. I don't use real people because it's incredibly powerful writing, and everything is a misrepresentation, even if it's a very valuable one. Laudable, flattering, gratifying. It's not reality.
Although that story is about a memoir, can't the same thing be said about the internet? Sometimes somebody posts a story online and it takes on a life of its own with many people believing it to be fact.
Well, that seems to be happening all around us at a fantastic clip.
The story has lots of funny moments, such as when they were shooting a movie scene with an actor, an actress, and a dog, and everybody's on edge, and you write, even if they could budget in an extra day to shoot the scene again, the dog has another commitment. Was that based on anything that you heard?
No. No, but I think it must work that way, that these remarkably well-trained animals are in great demand, I think, for film and TV.
The memoirist is Clement Rouse, and his grandfather Anton was a famous director who escaped Nazi Germany. One of the other characters speaking about him remarks, "People always say, oh, things might not be great here, but it's stable. Our problems are ordinary." And then the next thing you know, laws are gutted, the economy comes crashing down, people are in the streets. It's all the fault of the ones with beards or without beards or whoever.
Yeah. And
that sounds very much like what's happening right now in the lead up to this election.
Absolutely. Again, I wrote this maybe 5 years ago, but we're right in the middle of a culture of frantic scapegoating and terrible the utilization of prejudices. And every day, who look around, children are being shot, black people are being shot. Today, two women were shot because they were women. Jews are being shot. It really is just absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And it's all a result of the unleashing and legitimizing of virulent and inaccurate prejudices.
They never seem to go away. I was wondering why. For example, we're seeing a resurgence of Nazism in Austria, in France. Marine Le Pen's party is gaining in popularity. In Italy, the neo-fascists are part of the government. In Hungary, there is something that looks very close to a neo-Nazi thing. Do these people not remember what all of that, the destructiveness of that in the 30s and 40s?
Apparently memory is not the problem.
Well, but they must study history.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, everybody has the information. It's a matter of what one wants to do with the information. It's very terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. I don't know, Lenny, you may feel this way, but also I feel that we were born I was born at the exact end of what seemed to be the exact end of fascism in Europe. And certainly through my youth, I thought, well, that's over. But as you say, it never goes away. It never goes away.
And also, there are people in this country who see Hitler and Mussolini as heroes.
Yes.
Your story, The Third Tower, continues with the theme of language. And this one's this one is a dystopia where language is wielded as a conformity tool.
Yes. As I believe it partially is now, that's certainly one of its social or political functions. That, incidentally, was the last completed, and that was the one that Dan Halpern was so generously helpful with, because it is very different, really, from my other stories. And it took me quite some time to get a solid footing in it. I really had to make a number of radically different drafts.
And why is that? Because you're just not exactly sure what you want to say in the story?
Well, that's always the problem. But usually I have guideposts that are more securely placed, as you say, a more naturalistic world. I mean, I always sort of slide, I think particularly in these stories, I slide a little bit away from naturalism, and Merge slides a little farther, and The Third Tower slides very far. But the closer you are, and usually my stories are set in the present, although these most of these are not set in exactly the present. They're set in some parallel time.
And sometimes you like to have an ambiguous setting as well.
Yes.
The writer in the review in the New York Times wrote that the ambiguous gift of Eisenberg's characters is that they never become fully acclimated to our planet, to its beauty or horror, or mundanity, for that matter. Even the smallest activity remains monstrously difficult. And quote you, I began to unpack, but there was the issue of putting things wherever. That sounds like what you've been saying about how your approach to writing as well.
Yes, it seemed to be a curse that everything was incomprehensible to me and I couldn't manage to do anything, but maybe it's some sort of blessing.
Now, in the face of it, this collection of stories is maybe regarded as your least political book, and yet politics is everywhere. It's impossible to escape it?
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose my first book was almost devoid of identifiable politics.
But then you wrote stories about Central America.
Yes,
and
yes.
I was thinking about them with this invasion that we are now being warned about.
Oh, isn't this just the most tragic and horrifying thing that these poor people struggling their way up from situations of our creation are being vilified and criminalized. And then one thinks of the children in these concentration camps at the border. It's just, one can hardly believe the wickedness of all this.
How did you become interested in the situation in Central America?
Excuse me. Well, my wonderful sweetheart, Wally Shawn, who you've mentioned, became very interested in socialist economies and seeing what was going on. And he wanted to have a look at Nicaragua, since the news we were getting up here was obviously inaccurate and very, very incomplete. And
this is at the time of the Sandinistas. And
exactly. It was after the Sandinista revolution, but while we were funding the Contras to take down that government, which has now, alas, turned in on itself and taken itself down in a way. I was very ignorant about the situations in various Central American countries, particularly Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. But when I began to read about them and read and understand what my hard-earned tax dollars were going to support, I became very interested.
It occurred to me once that when I read works of fiction that take place in a certain time, I actually learn all sorts of things that I could never have learned from reading a history of that time.
Yes. Yes. I mean, my objective for my own writing is not to be educational. I'm not really interested in that. Nor is my objective as a reader. I'm an aesthete, and I love to read beautiful or fascinating, compelling things.
And write really interesting sentences.
And write really interesting sentences. But like you, I have found that I'd say the greater part of my education has come through reading fiction, reading Dickens as a child. I really learned a lot about the paradigms that are informing our life today, to say nothing about learning about Dickens's England.
And the same applies to the great Russian writers, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, check off.
Absolutely.
Not only learn about the human condition, you also learn about all sorts of complicated political things, even when politics aren't explicitly discussed.
Speaking of which, and speaking of your series of underread books, Turgenev's Spring Torrents is, I think, the best thing I've ever read about slavery, even though the word is mentioned once.
We did talk about his book, Virgin Soil, which is about the revolutionaries who are actually leading to the assassination of the Tsar. And reading it, you're very much reminded of 1968 in this country and even some more recent things.
Yes, yeah.
So I guess the human condition is always the human condition.
It's all too human, all too human.
I'm assuming you're in the process of working on some more stories.
You
did write a play.
I did write a play.
Are you tempted to do that again?
It doesn't depend on me. So, oh, you mean write another play? Mm. Not really. I love writing fiction, and I'm not in the process of anything. Mm. But, yes, I mean, plays are absolutely wonderful for those who are good at them. Mm. It's not my forte.
Although you write good dialogue.
Yes. thank you. I enjoy writing dialogue a lot, and it would be fun to do something pretty much all in dialogue.
And why of all of the, I mean, I think Jennifer Bartlett's a wonderful artist, but why of all the artists in the world did you focus on her for your only work of nonfiction?
Well, it just sort of happened, really. I always loved her work, and I'm sort of wired wrong for art in general. I'm not great at looking at art, but her art always spoke to me. And somebody was doing a series of writers on artists.
Although it is interesting that the narrator of the title story in this book, Your Duck is My Duck, is an artist, although she's an artist who's floundering around when the story takes place.
She had to be something.
She did do something wonderful in the past, the painting that starts off that story, Blue Hill, is one of her best works, but also tied to something personal because her husband had had it, her ex-husband, and it begins when he sells it to these people.
Yes, we don't know that they're married, but. Yes, he sells her wonderful painting, and I was very happy to have produced a wonderful painting, but I have no idea what it looks like.
Well, that's the great thing about writing. You can say it's a great painting.
Yes, yeah. He gave away her best thing.
Well, and the marriage fell apart as well.
True.
In your case, 40 years with the same partner, that's pretty impressive.
40 years is pretty impressive. Yes, with just on its own, it's pretty impressive. But yes, with the same person, it is. But if whoever would have been with him for 40 years or will be from now on, will be very happy because you can't be bored even for an instant.
Now, I mentioned that it took you 12 years to complete the stories in this book. So am I going to have to wait 12 years to talk to you again?
I hope not. I hope not. And I hope we've got 12 years left.
The book, the latest collection of short stories by Deborah Eisenberg is Your Duck is My Duck. It is published by Echo. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lenny. Thank you very, very much.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Deborah Eisenberg, to Susie Stultz, who produced the segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who is at the audio controls today. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site. which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.